Hi there. You're listening to the Hellenistic Age Podcast, interview episode, Coins and Numismatics in Greek Central Asia, with Dr. Frank Lee Holt. Hello, everyone. Today I have with me Dr. Frank Lee Holt, a professor of the Department of History at the University of Houston. Dr. Holt is an expert of Hellenistic Central Asia, whose work emphasizes the importance of numismatics with regards to the study of the Greco-Bactrian and Indo-Greek kingdoms. He has written several landmark books on the subject, including Thundering Zeus, The Making of Hellenistic Bactria, Lost World of the Golden King, In Search of Ancient Afghanistan, and Into the Land of Bones, Alexander the Great in Afghanistan. And for this episode, he has joined us on the show to discuss his work on Greco-Bactrian numismatics. First off, I would like to just say thank you so much for taking the time to speak on the show.
It's my pleasure, Derek. I appreciate the work that you're doing for Hellenistic history.
Could you tell us a bit about your background and how you ended up focusing your studies on the Hellenistic world and numismatics in general?
Certainly. I first became interested in the Hellenistic age as a student in college. I can remember taking a course on Greek history, and toward the end, the professor, who really had no specialty in Greek history at all, he was the English history professor, but occasionally taught a course on the ancient Greeks. And he started talking about the Hellenistic age. And I can remember thinking, anything that begins with hell can't be good. What's this going to be about? And so I finally began to understand where the term Hellenistic came from, that it had nothing to do with the Greek Hades at all. And he began to spin these marvelous stories about Greek ships being rowed up and down the Indus River with Greeks who had been left and lost in Central and South Asia. And I came to understand that he hadn't read many books about the ancient Greeks, but one of them that he had read was by William Woodthorpe Tarn, the magisterial book of the Greeks in Bactria and India. And so that professor had read that book and more or less conveyed to my class the excitement, the extraordinary painstaking work that Tarn had done to try to reconstruct the history of the Greeks in Bactria and India. And that always stuck with me, that his excitement came over so strongly that it imbued me with this interest in the subject. And then when I went on to graduate school, I had to make a decision. I was both an English major and a history major. I decided to go to graduate school in history. I wasn't from an academic background, so I didn't have a lot of guidance as to how one chooses a career in academia and so forth. But I settled on the University of Virginia and studied there with a very good Macedonian scholar by the name of Harry James Dell, who had studied under Charles Edson at the University of Wisconsin. And Dell taught a course very early in my career on the Hellenistic world. And I got the opportunity then to read more about it, not only Tarn's work, but works by, let's say, A.K. Narayan and others about the Greek experience in the East. And of course, I had to write a seminar paper, which I did, and went on to write a master's thesis on the reign of one of the Bactrian kings, Eucratides the Great. And when I told my professor that I wanted to go ahead and do a PhD dissertation on the Bactrians, he said, well, you need to know coins. And so I applied and was accepted to the summer seminar in numismatics at the American Numismatic Society in New York. And that's when I first got my hands on a large number of Bactrian coins to study. And that only increased my enthusiasm for the subject. It was a fantastic experience. The ANS, the American Numismatic Society, does a tremendous job of training graduate students in the field. And out of that seminar in New York, I wrote a paper that was published in Revue Numismatique in France about a hoard of coins from the archaeological site of Ai Khanum in northern Afghanistan. And that was sort of the beginning of a fairly active publication career on all matters from Alexander down to the collapse of the Bactrian kingdom in the East. And so, yeah, it's been 40 years or so that I've been doing this sort of thing, and I find it still endlessly fascinating. There's so much work yet to be done. I hope I'm allowed another lifetime or two to try to attempt to accomplish all those things.
Now, as my listeners are no doubt aware by this point, Greco-Bactria and the later Indo-Greek kingdoms have a notoriously poor presence in the literary record, with only a few blurbs from those like Polybius, Justin, or Strabo. Thus, numismatics, the study of coins, remains one of the most valuable tools. While the history of numismatics and coin hunting in Bactria in India is a tale in of itself, how did coins become the primary resource for understanding the history of Greek Central Asia and India?
I'd like to point out two books that I've done that address that issue. The earlier book, Lost World of the Golden King, traces the history of the rediscovery of Bactria through coins. And then just a few months ago, I published another book with Oxford called When Money Talks, A History of Coins and Numismatics. And there, your listeners can get a much more detailed idea of how coins can reveal to us histories of places such as ancient Bactria. Now, in one of those, I have a list of the translations of all the surviving texts regarding ancient Bactria. And that takes up only a couple of pages. So it's very little literary evidence at all. And so you're right, it does come down to physical evidence, to coins first, and now more recently, we've been aided by archaeological discoveries. Now, what makes coins so important for us is simply the durability of coins as historical evidence. When you think about how history is normally recorded for us, the histories of, let's say, a Polybius or Thucydides, they have to survive on papyrus or on parchment. But coins are struck in durable metals, gold, silver, bronze, in case of the Bactrians, even nickel. And because these metals are durable, they tend to survive for us. Furthermore, they're minted in massive numbers. You don't mint 10 coins, 20 coins. Normally, you will mint hundreds of thousands, if not millions of coins. And so the chance of some of those coins surviving as evidence is relatively high. And coins are a continuous record. As you know, if you study history in terms of literary texts, where we have a marvelous set for the 5th century BC, the classical period, we have Herodotus and Thucydides. And then we have Xenophon taking us into the 4th century. But by the time you get to the Hellenistic age, the literary evidence that survives becomes very spotty indeed. Whereas coins are a continuous record. Coins are minted by cities in almost a continuous pattern. And during the reigns of kings of various Hellenistic dynasties, each king is minting coins. And so there are normally no gaps left in the numismatic record. I can also point out that because coins are valuable, particularly the gold and silver, ancient peoples buried a lot of them. They hid them. And by hiding them, they, in many cases, remain for us to rediscover today. And some of the largest hoards of ancient coins ever to be found have been found in the region of ancient Bactria, modern-day Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan. So because of those buried hoards, we have an elevated chance of recovering a full spectrum of numismatic evidence. So if you combine that survivability with the fact that coins are the earliest form of mass communication, they are tiny disks of information technology, not unlike what we have today. And the idea of, let's say, a Bactrian king was to compress upon that disk, that mobile disk that's going to go out and convey the messaging of the reign, is to cram as much information as possible on it. You cram image, you cram text. Ancient people used these coins in similar ways to our dependability upon, let's say, cell phones. We use cell phones for images, for text, to record things, to look things up. And coins did the same thing. Very carefully, information was selected and put on those tiny surfaces, the two sides of a coin, the obverse and reverse. And that messaging to the contemporaries of an ancient Hellenistic king can be interpreted by us today. And therefore, it presents to us a whole panorama of information that otherwise would be lost.
Untrained eye, there may be a degree of confusion in differentiating the coins between monarchs, never mind figuring out a general order in absence of a corresponding written narrative. How do numismatists classify and distinguish coins from one another? Are there any specific markers on the coin specimens that aid in the process, such as iconography, epigraphy, or stamps?
That is indeed a very good question. We know from literary texts the names of only seven ancient kings of Bactria. We know from coins about three dozen more. So we need those coins to help us create these chronologies, these lists of kings and so forth. Now, the study of coins, numismatics, has evolved a great deal over the last few centuries. And indeed, that's the process I trace in my book, Lost World of the Golden King. And I've identified six types of investigations of ancient coins. That is how we go about using coins to distinguish between different rulers and to classify history and so forth. Now, the first and most elementary way is what I call checklist numismatics, where you have, let's say, from literary sources, a surviving list of seven kings. We know that there were these seven kings in Bactria. And we try to check off from that list coins. You find a coin, you hope that it will be a coin from one of those kings. And gradually, all seven of those kings were checked off in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. It's not unlike how today some coin collectors buy a coin album, and it will have a little slot for every kind of coin minted in a series, and you stick a representative coin in each slot until you check off the entire list. That was the earliest kind of numismatics. Then came framework numismatics, where you find coins that are not known to us by any other source. A name shows up on a coin, like Agathocles, let's say. And then you have to figure out an historical framework in which to put that coin. Relative to the seven known kings, where are we going to put this newly discovered king, Agathocles? And as I say, more and more of those kings and queens were discovered by explorers in Afghanistan. Until now, there are more than three dozen of those kings and queens that have had to be worked into an historical framework. And then there are other kinds of numismatics, novelty numismatics, which deals with the outliers or the unique coins, like the large 20-stater coin of Eucratides. Narrative numismatics, championed by William Tarn, that I mentioned to you earlier. Rescue numismatics now because of the turmoil in places like Afghanistan. And finally, something that I've created called cognitive numismatics. And so these are various ways, various types of investigations you can use when you're studying coins. Now, to get to your question about what do you look for, what are the markers? A numismatist has to look at everything on a coin. It has to be the most painstaking examination possible. Coins are relatively small, and so a lot can be hidden on them if you're not trained to look for them carefully. Once you begin to look at coins, you begin to classify them. You begin to compare them to each other, and you create what archaeologists would call a typology, a kind of evolution of coins. Any numismatist can look at a group of coins and almost immediately say, all right, I know that this is a Hellenistic coin. It's not a coin from the classical or archaic age. The design and so forth of the coin are that different. The same thing is true in Roman coinage. Anyone can look at a group of coins and say, oh, this coin is clearly from the Roman Empire, and this coin is clearly from the Roman Republic. I don't even have to read the names on it to know that they are that different. And so in Hellenistic coins, for example, the legends, that is, the inscription stamped upon them from the Latin for to read, the thing on the coin that you were supposed to read, the inscription, they get more and more complicated and verbose as the Hellenistic age goes on. So when you look at Hellenistic coins, if you see a Hellenistic coin and it simply says King Euthydemus, King Diodotus, well, you already know that's relatively early, because as time goes on, their successors begin to add more and more titles to those coins, epithets we call them. They become more and more grandiose, you know, not just king, but great king, or not just king, but the benefactor king. And we can see an evolution in terms of what's stamped on the coin. In Bactria, the coins become over time bilingual rather than simply being minted in Greek. The monograms or the little lettering stamped on the coin that seems to be composed of a little symbol or a little group of letters that might identify the mint or the magistrate or something, they become more complex over time. Portraiture changes over time. The earliest Bactrian coins will show kings who wear a diadem but nothing else on their heads. Later on, they become much more elaborate with helmets and hats and things of that type. the shape of the coins will change and so forth. So every little detail on the coin is important in terms of working out the kind of historical framework in which these coins will fit. And I've written whole articles just on how one little element on a coin might slightly change over time. For example, if Heracles is holding a club and the lion pelt in his arm, if the lion pelt over time tends to rotate from full frontal to a side view, you can put that in order, and it's a chronological marker that you can follow in the evolution of the coins.
Now, leading off from my previous question, are there any perils and pitfalls that can occur when relying too much on coinage to recreate a story?
Absolutely. Just as you have to be so painstaking in looking at coins, you can sometimes get lost in the minutiae of coins too. You have to remember to pull back. You have to remember not to over-specialize in any kind of evidence. And this is dangerous if you're a papyrologist and you know nothing but papyrology. That can be a problem for historians. And the same thing is true with numismatics. So you have to be able to step back and look at things. And then, of course, there is that lure of the literary narrative. Historians naturally write in narrative form. And so when you take someone like William Tarn, writing in 1938, and he looks at all this scattered evidence, and he's the first to try to pull it together to create a history of this Bactrian kingdom, it's a history that he wants to write in narrative fashion, not just this king followed this king followed this king. What kind of kings were there? What were their personalities like? How were they related to each other? Did they like or dislike the Seleucids to the west? Did they like or dislike the subject peoples, the Central Asian populations or the populations of India over whom they ruled? He wanted that whole story to be told. He wanted it to be exciting and eventful and tragic and full of twists and turns, almost like a soap opera. And of course, that's what makes his work so interesting to us, but it is an overreach of the evidence. And ever since Tarn published, we have had to try to go back and say, that's a grand idea, this theory of his, but it doesn't hold up. The evidence will not support this kind of investigation. For example, Tarn was very much influenced by physiognomy, by the study of people's faces. And because he believed that on Bactrian coins in particular, the artist captured the essence, the true quality of each king, he doted on these artists who carved the dies from which the coins were made. And he said, when you look at that face of that king, Euthydemus, for example, or of Demetrius, then you can judge from that image the personality of that particular ruler. In other words, the portrait was made to equal the personality. And he was drawing upon some very suspect ideas, going back to Francis Galton, who was the father of modern eugenics, and Flinders Petrie, the Egyptologist, who was also, unfortunately, very much a racist in some of the views that he held. And so Tarn would look at a face and say, okay, this person was haughty and proud. And so that will figure into my narrative of what he did as king. Even kings about whom we have no surviving evidence whatever, he gave them a personality. He created relationships. Oh, this must be the brother of this other king, or this has to be the son of this other king. He invented marriages in order to create a kind of soap opera family, even though these queens are in no way attested in the ancient sources. He would say, oh, well, this king, Diodatus, first was married to this queen, then and had a child, and then he married this other queen, and then the rival children of these two marriages fought each other and so forth, and again, went very far out on a limb in trying to create these kinds of narratives. And so when I gave my list to you earlier of the kinds of numismatics that we have, and I listed narrative numismatics as one of them, that's one of the most popular still. I mean, people still prefer that numismatists write in terms of narratives, and some do. But I have tried to show that we have to go beyond that and try new kinds of approaches that aren't so dependent upon such subjective views of how someone looks on the portrait of a coin, if we can even believe that someone actually looked that way. Of course, you can idealize portraits and things of that type.
For many, the coins of the Greco-Bactrians and Indo-Greeks occupy a special place in the eyes of numismatists and, somewhat infamously, collectors alike. For instance, the largest known gold coin ever minted during the ancient world was the Eucratidian, struck on behalf of King Eucratides I, and discovered in Bukhara in the late 19th century. When compared to contemporary powers like the Seleucids or the Ptolemies, was the coinage of Greco-Bactria unique, whether in terms of its quality or scale? Or do we place special emphasis on any finds given the scarcity of our sources to begin with?
Another good question. You know, the more we focus our attentions on the coinages of one region of the Hellenistic world, the more inclined we are to say, oh, this is special or this is unique. And that's why I said earlier, you have to pull back occasionally and say, okay, how do these coins do compare with those of the Ptolemies or those of the Antigonids or those of the Seleucids? And when you step back and make those comparisons, you can see that there are these overarching broad themes of typologies that are there. For example, it's at about the same time in the Seleucid Empire as in ancient Bactria that epithets, these royal titles, begin to proliferate on coins. Obviously, one region is influencing another. We know, for example, that the coin type of Eucratides that you just mentioned, with the Dioscuri on the reverse and Eucratides wearing this famous bullhorn helmet, that coin was copied by Timarchus, upstart in the West in the Seleucid Empire. So these coins were moving about and they were influencing different states. It's obvious that Timarchus sees a coin of Eucratides, that's the design I want, you know. Make that design, but put my name on it, and even took Eucratides' title, Great King, and so forth. So there is a lot of connectivity going on between the coinages within the Hellenistic world. Now, that said, it is true that each region has some sort of local patterns that differentiate them from others. For example, the Ptolemaic coins are not nearly as diverse in the coin types and so forth as those of the Seleucid Empire or those that you would find in Bactria or the Indo-Greek kingdoms that followed. So that's sort of an obvious thing too. But you mentioned one, of course. The largest gold coin ever minted in the ancient world was minted in Bactria by Eucratides, that 20-stater gold piece. It happens that the largest silver coin minted anywhere in the ancient world was minted in Bactria by a later king named Amyntas. And it's interesting that it's a, just as the Eucratides coin is a 20-stater coin, 20 times the normal stater, the silver coin is 20 times the normal drachma. And why? I've racked my brain for years. What's going on here? Why do we have these multiple of 20 for these coins? And some people think it's these are just special tribute coins that are created to pay off the threatening nomads to the north of Bactria. So you don't mint a bunch of coins, you just mint a few huge coins to send up there to placate these potential rivals to you. So there is size, that sort of numismatic megalomania is going on in Bactria that you don't really find anywhere else. There are a few bilingual issues across the Hellenistic world, but by far in Bactria and India, they are more prolific. The Bactrians really do eventually create a true bilingual coinage that is generally called Indo-Greek, that is as much Indian in design as it is Greek. You have a few specialized things. For example, I love the fact that two of the Bactrian kings, Agathocles and Antimachus, minted a series of what are called commemorative or pedigree coins, which are, again, quite unusual, in which, let's say, Agathocles is commemorating the coinages of earlier kings in Bactria. Going back to Alexander, he's got Alexander, and then he's got Antiochus and Diodotus I and II, and he's got Euthydemus and Demetrius and his older brother Pantaleon. So this is an interesting group of coins. First of all, that confirms our chronology. Because Agathocles commemorated Pantaleon, we know that Pantaleon reigned at the same time or earlier than Agathocles and not later, something that we would not perhaps know otherwise. And those coins have on them not just simple inscriptions, but you know, what we classicists get excited about. It has a genitive absolute, a verbal construction, basileontas, during the reign of Agathocles. In essence, this coin was minted. So it's the same phrase that begins the Rosetta Stone, Basiluontas, during the reign of. That's something quite interesting for the Bactrian coins. Also, we have the number of coins from Bactrian India that attest otherwise unknown kings is off the scale in terms of Hellenistic history as a whole. And we're still finding new kings who reign briefly in parts of Bactria and India. And finally, of course, I alluded to this earlier, there were some nickel or cupro-nickel, copper-nickel coins minted by three of the Bactrian kings, Euthydemus II, Pantaleon, and Agathocles. And nickel was not used by any other ancient coinages and would not be used again until the modern period. There are unique things about the Bactrian coins. Now, the one thing I didn't mention is what almost everyone expected me to mention at first, and that is this idea that the Bactrians are the most beautiful coin series ever produced in the ancient world. Because that's such a subjective statement, I tend to shy away from it. They certainly are stunning coins in many ways, but I wouldn't say that there are no rivals to the Bactrian coins produced by any of the other thousands of kings, queens, emperors, and so forth of the ancient world.
Establish a general chronology, what can coins tell us about the structure and landscape of Bactria that we might otherwise miss when we just focus on a list of kings and dates? Are there any byproducts of coin making that can add to our knowledge as well?
Absolutely. And of course, I don't want to skip past chronology too quickly because chronology is such an important thing. I did a whole article in 2012 on how coins are the only way to accurately date when the Greeks abandoned the fabulous Hellenistic city of Ai Khanum in northern Afghanistan. So chronology is, of course, a fundamental thing. But you're right, we can go beyond that to look at things like the structure of the state. In my book, Thundering Zeus, I took the coinage of the first two independent kings of Bactria, Dodatus I and his son, Dodatus II. Coinages that are very difficult to separate from each other. How do you know which Dodatus issued this coin? Is it the earlier Dodatus or the later Dodatus? The coins don't put those Roman numerals on there for us, Dodatus number one and Dodatus number two. We have to figure that out for ourselves. And so in that book, I worked out a structure of the Bactrian state in which I was able to show that these coins can be differentiated from these coins. These are the coins of the elder Dodatus. These are the coins of the younger Dodatus, but that they overlap, that the structure of the state wasn't so simple that Dodatus I reigned and died and his coins stopped. And then his son started issuing his coins as Dodatus until he died and they stopped. Their reigns overlap. Dodatus II was elevated to the position of king on the Seleucid model. I mean, the Seleucids had already done this successfully earlier on. And so I was able to show numismatically that that Seleucid model, joint reigns between father and son, giving the son a head start, if you will, carried over into the Hellenistic Bactria also. It's also clear in terms of structures of the state that there were two separate economies. There was a Greco-Bactrian economy north of the Hindu Kush mountain range, where the coins are on the Attic standard. And then there's a separate Indian economy south of the Hindu Kush, in which the Greeks had to mint coins on a different Indianized weight standard. And that this clear demarcation shows us something about where the line was drawn between managing the economy of Bactria and managing the economy of these emerging Indo-Greek states south of the Hindu Kush. And you can go beyond that. I mentioned earlier cognitive numismatics is something I've tried to introduce more recently, in which you look at coins not from the point of view simply of the issuing authority of the monarch. It's been said by some people that Hellenistic coins can tell us nothing except about the kings who issued them. And of course, that couldn't be further from the truth. You can also learn a great deal about the people who use those coins in terms of where those coins show up in the archaeological record and so forth. But you can also examine how those coins were made. If you look at coins carefully enough, you can transport yourself back into the ancient mint, back to the moment of the coin's creation, to see how these coins were made. For example, early on, I discovered that if you studied the mistakes that are made in the myths, when some person is carving the inscription on the die that will produce Greek coins for that person's king, and that person makes a mistake or a series of mistakes, that tells us something. The rate at which mistakes are made tells us even more. And I was able to identify certain periods and certain reigns when the coinage level of error rose dramatically. And this has to be in response to some kind of crisis. For example, the sudden need to issue many more coins than you'd been done before. And so there cannot be the same kind of management, the same kind of oversight on coins. Coin mistakes aren't corrected. They get into circulation. And so a coin that misspells the king's title or the king's name, and with each die, you're making tens of thousands of those coins. They go out there. And the fact that they are not caught at the mint, that they're not corrected, gives us a kind of roadmap for the stress levels within the mints themselves. And you can also look at literacy. How literate were these die engravers? Can we tell something about ethnicity? Was the person who made this mistake, carving out this Greek inscription, was that person really Greek, or was that person non-Greek and struggling with the language? All of those things we can look into in terms of cognitive numismatics, looking at how coins are made, how they're used, how they're reused, and so forth, by studying these errors and mental processes. So we study the errors on the coins, we study the dies from which the coins were made, we look at the metallurgy. Can we trace where the metal came from that goes into these coins, and so forth?
As Greek kings ruling over a population of primarily Iranian or Bactrian origin, how did those like the Diodotids or the Euthydemids communicate through their coins? Are there any interesting observations or conclusions we can draw on based upon the type of imagery that they chose to present?
There certainly is. For example, if we look at the coins of, let's say, the Diodotids, at first, these coins look as though they're entirely Greek for a Greek population without any real nod to the subject population, the subhistoric population, the people who live below the threshold of history. There's no overt evidence on those coins of any appeal being made to the non-Greek population of Bactria. And then you notice something very curious, and that is that on some bronze coins, which are normally made for local distribution, gold and silver travel far and wide. Bronze normally doesn't travel too far from the area in which it was minted, and so it's more of a localized coinage. On some of those Diodotus bronze coins, you have on the obverse the portrait of Zeus, and on the reverse, an image of Artemis. And this, of course, is entirely Greek. And on some of those coins, the earlier coins, Artemis has running along beside her a dog, because Artemis is the huntress goddess, and her hunting hound is a very common attribute, part of iconography in the Greek world. And so, of course, the Greek king in the Greek mint issued an image of Artemis that the Greeks would recognize. But I noticed something early on studying those coins, and that is eventually the dog disappears. It's just Artemis running along holding a torch hunting in the night, but her dog's gone. And so what happened to the dog? And it occurred to me, and this is only a theory, of course, because there's no text that I can use to confirm it, that the dog was a real point of contention between the ruling Bactrians and the subject peoples who tended to be Zoroastrian. And, you know, we have the famous story of when Alexander first marched into Bactria and first went into the capital city, Bactra, that he and his army were horrified that there were the bones of recently dead local population being gnawed on by dogs that were called locally the devourer dogs, because part of the Zoroastrian religion was not to defile a body by cremating it, as Alexander had done his father. I mean, cremation for the Greeks was a perfectly acceptable way of disposing of a body. For the Zoroastrians, nothing worse could be done than to defile fire by throwing a dead body in it. Instead, you let dogs and carrion birds devour the corpse, wherever the corpse may be. And Alexander marched in and he said, this is going to stop. This offends our Greek sensibilities, because for the Greeks, there was nothing worse than letting a body be devoured by wild animals. That's the whole underlying story in For example, Sophocles' play Antigone, the fact that her brother's body is being left out in the open to be eaten by wild animals was horrific to her as a Greek. And so what had occurred to me is, how did the local people react to that dog running at the feet of Artemis? Did they see a devourer dog, which was contrary to the laws set down in Bactria since the time of Alexander? And therefore, the dotted rulers and their mints decided, let's just get the dog off the coin. It's creating a kind of cultural war going on here as to what this dog means and whether we should have these dogs running wild again or not. Don't know if that's true, but it's an interesting way in which we might find communication, because it's not just important what's on the coin. It's important what's not on the coin, particularly if it's taken off the coin. And then, of course, continue this idea further. Obviously, as time goes on beyond the Diodotus, by the time we get to kings like Eucratides and Agathocles and Antimachus, we're getting more and more bilingual coins that are clearly responding to their presence in on the south side of the Hindu Kush mountains and involving in their economies, in their reigns, more and more people of Indian background rather than Greek background. And so, and eventually Agathocles is the first to mint a coin on which the deities are not Greek at all. They are Hindu deities. And so these concessions are made over time by the Indo-Greek kings of the Hellenistic world.
Published in 2012, your book, Lost World of the Golden King, chronicles the struggles of historians attempting to uncover the history of Greco-Bactria despite the geopolitical turmoil of the Great Game or the Cold War. Almost 10 years later after writing the book, we have just recently witnessed the exit of American troops from Afghanistan and its subsequent takeover by the Taliban. How has the political instability of the region affected our ability to recover and protect the history of Afghanistan and the surrounding areas, whether coins or anything else? What is your opinion on the fate or future of Greco-Bactrian research?
In a word, grim. The situation is quite devastating in Bactria, modern-day Afghanistan, as it is in Syria and other conflict zones. This is part of the problem that we face in large stretches of what was once the Hellenistic world. You know, and again, I recounted that history in my book, Lost World of the Golden King, and I've done so elsewhere also, about the looting of sites after the Soviet withdrawal in 1978 and the tragedy of sites like Ai Khanum, to which we hoped archaeologists might return to complete the excavations that had been abandoned there with the Soviet invasion in 78 and 79. But unfortunately, in the intervening turmoil, those sites were despoiled. It's unfortunate, for example, the United States sent huge shipments of metal detectors to Afghanistan. And this was back in the 1990s to help the population, as indeed we needed to locate and remove all the landmines that had been left behind by the Soviet occupiers. But one of the problems was that many of the warlords who were fighting each other in the power vacuum that was created when the Soviets withdrew, those warlords got their hands on those metal detectors and often took them to archaeological sites like Ai Khanum and simply used them to locate and dig up valuable antiquities. So that if you look at, and I've studied these extensively, satellite images of places like Ai Khanum, it is cratered like the moon. There are an estimated 10,000 deep craters dug into the site of Ai Khanum, each one the result of the pinging of a metal detector telling some looter that there's treasure lying here. And so that kind of devastation that struck Afghanistan is fast returning once again. There was some stability. Archaeologists did return to some sites during the period of the ISAF, the International Security Forces that went into Afghanistan after 9/11. There were some renewed excavations at places like Balkh or ancient Bactra and Mesh Einak and other sites. But now, my friends in the archaeological missions, the French delegation in Afghanistan, for example, have had to flee the country. And I'm sure that the museums there are likely in peril once more. In other words, the museum was, in the 1990s, the National Museum was deliberately bombed and ransacked by competing warlords in Kabul. And since that time, the museum was rebuilt. Some of its artifacts were repatriated, some hoard material, for example, the Golden Horde of Bactria, which had been saved by the heroic actions of the Afghan curators of the museum. Those things were restored. Now, whether or not they're going to survive this occupation by the Taliban or not is completely unknown. So I fear for what might happen. Once again, we may be looking at auction house sites for coins and discovering, as I've done in the past, there's a coin that was once in the Afghan Museum. It's being sold on the open market to people who have no idea it's a looted antiquity, but is easily recognizable if you've studied those coins as part of the museum's holdings. So it's a grim situation there. Archaeology has stopped. Whatever is found now, looters will easily reach the international market and will be sold. And there are whole stretches of history about which we might be blinded by the kind of greed that comes along in those situations. But now, having said that, I don't want to end on a completely gloomy note. I would like to point out that there is a rising generation of young Hellenistic scholars who are deeply devoted to the study of ancient Bactria and numismatics. And so some are my students, some are the students of my good friend Osman Boparachi, some are students from universities in Britain, people like Rachel Mayers and Francis Joseph and Olivier Bordeaux and Simon Glynn. These are the hope that the work that some of us have been doing for decades and being doing in trying times too, because again, Afghanistan has been in a state of war throughout most of my adult life. But I'm hoping that this young generation of scholars will not be discouraged and that they will continue on this kind of work in spite of the challenges that it presents. Stability may come back to the country again briefly at some point. If it does, I hope that they will be able to benefit greatly from whatever has been saved or salvaged during this crisis.
And on that note, I think that this is an excellent place to end our discussion. And I'd just like to say thank you so much once again for taking the time to come on the show. And are there any future projects in the works or plans for books on the Greco-Bactrian or the Indo-Greeks?
Well, I'm always looking into article and book projects. Currently, I'm working on one dealing with a mummy CT scan from Ptolemaic Egypt. So that's a little bit off the Bactrian trail, but I will be, I'm constantly working on things related to Bactrian and Indo-Greek history. And I can point out too that that I'm part of two kind of exciting signs of the future. And that is the Hellenistic world is becoming extremely interesting to scholars in China, extremely interesting to scholars in India. There's been recently created at Nankai University in China, the Hellenistic Culture and the Silk Road Project, which is producing a massive encyclopedia, multi-volume compendium of works by contributing scholars on all aspects of the Hellenistic world, particularly as it relates to the Silk Road. And that's going to generate a lot of Chinese scholarship in the future. And similarly, in New Delhi in India, just in a matter of the last few weeks, I helped inaugurate the Indo-Hellenic Research Center, which is devoted to all sorts of interactions between India and Greece. But in particular, of course, we might put the Indo-Greek period, the Hellenistic period of history. So the international range of efforts to uncover the history of the Hellenistic world is expanding greatly. I mean, when I first started as a Hellenistic historian, there weren't a great number of us. And now when you go to a site like academia.edu, that website, I looked recently, there are over 130,000 papers listed as Hellenistic, over 9,000 articles and over 8,000 books that are related to the Hellenistic world. So in my older age, I'm so excited by the fact that the Hellenistic world is more on the minds of scholars than it has ever been before. And I think that's a good sign for all of us. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and to your listeners.
I'd just like to say to all of you, thank you so much for tuning into the show. And in the meanwhile, you've been listening to the Hellenistic Age Podcast.